The headlines. China says it will take resolute and forceful measures over a brief visit by Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. British junior doctors push ahead with the latest round of their highly disruptive strike as the government rejects their pay rise demand. And public anger is mounting over the official response to the wildfires in the U.S. state of Hawaii as the death toll rises to 93. Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Taiwan. This is News. Thanks for joining us. China has strongly condemned the U.S. for arranging a visit by the Taiwanese Vice President William Lai. Beijing says it will take resolute and forceful measures to safeguard its national sovereignty and territorial integrity. The Chinese Foreign Ministry says that Beijing is firmly opposed to any form of official exchanges between the U.S. and Taiwan. It also labeled Lai a downright troublemaker. Lai is a vocal separatist and a candidate in Taiwan's presidential elections next year. He's officially making transit stops in the U.S. en route to and from Paraguay. China claims Taiwan as its own territory. Washington does not have formal diplomatic relations with the island, but maintains close ties with the territory and is its most important international source of weapons. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Junior doctors in the U.K. are on the third day of the latest round of the highly disruptive strike over pay. The industrial action began Friday and will continue until Tuesday. It includes action by doctors just days into the medical practice and could push the total number of appointments canceled due to the NHS strikes past 1 million. The junior doctors are demanding a 35% pay rise. The government says this is unrealistic and not negotiable. Its proposal is a fourth of what junior doctors seek. Rolling strikes by NHS staff since December are estimated to have cost the service nearly $1.3 billion. The number of people on waiting lists for treatment has also surged to a record 7.6 million. Syed Poor is our correspondent joining us from London. Also, Bob Gill is the producer of The Great NHS Heist, who also joins us from London. Welcome to you both. So, Syed, over to you first. I'm guessing that this should be a starter, 35% as opposed to the 6% that Rishi Sunak said is non-negotiable. That was just barely, I think, about 3 weeks ago or a month ago. So where do things stand, really, when it comes to these doctors who are on strike?
Yeah, that offer from the government came after the pay review body suggested that amount, as well as more than 1,200 pounds of one-off pay to wages, hoping that they could put this to rest. But it hasn't happened. And yes, as far as things stand, it is a deadlock. There doesn't seem to be any progress, although we understand that there might be informal negotiations going on between the two sides. The government, as you say, said, look, that's our final offer. We're not going to come to the negotiating table. And the junior doctors, the unions are saying, as long as there's no parity, that there's no pay restoration, they're not returning to the negotiating table either. So hence the situation we're in now. But as to how we got in here, of course, the strikes come hot on the heels of that number that you read earlier, of the NHS waiting list going past 7.5 million. Although the doctor would like, the government would like to say that this is the result of the strike action that's been going on since December last year, when the junior doctors first walked out their job off their jobs. The unions are saying, look at the numbers since 2010. In 2010, the numbers were at 2.5 million. By right before the pandemic, it was at 5 million, and right before they took industrial action, it was already at 7 million. While they're saying while the strikes are having an impact, there are other more fundamental issues that are affecting and plaguing the NHS, the National Health Service. One important reason is staffing, recruiting and retaining the staff in the NHS, and not just junior doctors, it's the nurses and all the other people who work for this fabled National Health Service, or what is left of it. I'm sure Dr. Gill will have a lot to say about that. You're looking at doctors who are leaving the profession in their droves. They are going all the way to places such as Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and elsewhere, where conditions and pay wages are higher. Some of them are saying, look, try and walk in our shoes. You are a doctor. You are dealing with life and death situations, telling people when they're going to die, things like that. You and then you have to worry about your rent or your bills. You shouldn't have to do that. And they're saying if the Secretary of Health believes that we are worth nearly 20 pounds an hour, then we're going to call this off. But that is not happening. And the government has really dug in as far as its position is concerned, saying it's not happening. Uh-huh. And we're not going to do that 35% you're asking for.
Did you say 20 pounds an hour, Saeed?
Nearly 20 pounds an hour.
Right. All right.
Right now, as it stands, they're making less than someone who is working, for example, in PrEP, which is getting paid the minimum wage, is just over 10 pounds an hour.
Okay. So how do we approach this conversation, Bob, taking a look at what's happening? Because as I mentioned to a correspondent there, you know, when you had Rishi Sunak say this is it, you know, I think it was 6% pay raise at the most. My question to you is, I would think that in the case of doctors and nurses in the medical field, there should be an exception where you shouldn't have one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to pay increases, because after all, these people are responsible for people's lives, generally speaking. So I'll start off with that. Don't you think that an exception should have been made?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand the background. Over the past decade, NHS staff have experienced a 25% real terms wage cut. So if your wages have shrunk, in order to restore their value, it has to be increased by 30% plus to get to where you were 10 years ago. So although the figure may sound high, it's purely about restoring the wages. Now, if you don't restore the wages, we've experienced high inflation, cost of living is going through the roof. Year on year, doctors and nurses have got poorer and poorer, and they are struggling to make ends meet. And if you add on top of that the responsibility of the work, this is untenable. So the problem with recruitment and retention is directly linked to the government's deliberate wage suppression policy. Then you might ask yourself, well, why are they doing this? And they're doing it because the NHS is no longer what it used to be. It's been totally repurposed over years of legislation, and now it resembles the American model, which is publicly funded but privately controlled and privately delivered. And these private companies want a very cheap workforce. So they don't want expensive, you know, well-qualified people. In fact, they're replacing doctors with non-doctors. The government is not worried about the waiting list, because the waiting list has been rising before the pandemic and before strike action, but they now have a convenient scapegoat. But government policy is to deliberately drive up waiting lists, to drive down wages, and they've handed control of our healthcare to private companies to extract as much profit as possible.
Thank you, Saeed, for the update there, and thank you, Bob Gill, producer of the great NHS Heist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. The death toll from the Hawaii wildfires has risen to 93 amid growing anger over the response to the deadliest U.S. blaze in 100 years. Hawaiian authorities are saying that the number of fatalities will increase further as hundreds are still unaccounted for. The fire has damaged or destroyed more than 2,200 structures in the hardest-hit town of Lahaina. It also left thousands homeless. Officials have launched an investigation into the handling of the fire, as residents are complaining that there had been no warnings. Hawaii Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says officials had underestimated the danger of the devastating fire. The blaze has been described as the worst natural disaster in the island's history. Iran and the U.S. have announced a deal to unblock Iranian assets frozen in South Korea due to U.S. sanctions. The deal follows indirect talks between Tehran and Washington, and also calls for a prisoner swap between the two sides. According to the Iranian Foreign Ministry, Tehran has received the necessary guarantees from the U.S. side in that regard.
D. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has announced the start of a process to unfreeze Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to American sanctions.
The process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry said the decision on how to utilize these unfrozen resources lies with the Islamic Republic of Iran, adding that the assets will be used to meet the country's needs. That followed claims that Iran's access to these assets will be limited. Meanwhile, under the deal, a number of Iranians whom the foreign ministry statement said are held in the U.S. under the false accusations of circumventing sanctions will be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran, whose freedom was sought by Washington, are still in Tehran. Iran's mission at the United Nations put the number of those prisoners at 5, that they have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. And Iran's Vice President for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, said the American prisoners will leave the country after Iranian assets are fully transferred to Tehran. It came after reports by U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and the CNN, quoted sources as saying that Washington will allow the transfer of nearly $6 billion of Iran's assets in South Korea to an account in the Central Bank of Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the prisoner swap, but said the U.S. will keep up sanctions against Iran.
In any event, in any respect, Iran will not be receiving any sanctions relief. And in any instance where we would engage in such efforts to bring Americans home from Iran, Iran's own funds would be used and transferred to restricted accounts such that the monies can only be used for humanitarian purposes, which, as you know, is permitted under our sanctions. There's an exemption for humanitarian that's there from the start.
The Islamic Republic has in the past rejected U.S. claims of sanctions exemptions for humanitarian purposes. Iran says the sanctions are inhumane and illegal and has directly affected its people's life.
The process of releasing Iran's assets in South Korea comes after Iranian funds blocked in Iraq were unfrozen last month. All those are seen as a victory for the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi, who has been pursuing what it calls a dignified diplomacy.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the 2015 Iran deal in 2018, restoring sanctions on the Islamic Republic. That was part of what Trump called a maximum pressure campaign, which has continued under his successor Joe Biden. Part of the campaign has resulted in business restrictions. But Iranian officials say the so-called pressure campaign has failed as Iran's oil exports has come closer to the figures prior to the reimposition of the sanctions. Statistical data also shows Iran's non-oil exports to the neighboring and friendly states have grown drastically in the past few years. Tehran has time and again blasted the U.S. for what it sees as addiction to sanctions. Based on a report in May 2022, Iran has between $100 and $120 billion trapped in foreign accounts because of the U.S. sanctions. The latest agreement between Tehran and Washington to release several billions of Iran's frozen assets is hailed as another example of an active and dignified diplomacy, policies that the administration of Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says are on its agenda to protect the rights of the Iranian people in any situation. And the latest deal is significant because it has preserved Iran's dignity as Tehran would not take the first step unless the U.S. shows its commitments under the deal. Also, it is the Islamic Republic that decides for which purposes it uses the unblocked funds, with the foreign ministry saying they would be used to meet the country's needs. The release of Iranian funds in South Korea comes after several billions of dollars of other Iranian assets frozen in Iraq were unblocked in July this year. Iran has time and again said it will continue to safeguard its rights and will never bow to outside pressure.
The chronic financial crisis of the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, is deeply worsening, especially in the second half of 2023. This has created concerns among Palestinian refugees that the UN agency could end all of its services as soon as September. Our Gaza correspondent Ola Alassi has more.
75 years after the forced displacement during the Nakba, Palestinian refugees are concerned about the dire financial crisis facing the UNRWA. Since its establishment in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, UNRWA has dedicated all its effort to help protect the Palestinian refugees by providing humanitarian services and supporting their education. 2023 marks the most dangerous year for over 5 million Palestinian refugees spread across the occupied territories, Jordan, Lebanon, and other countries. Here is where Hatem Mehjez, a Palestinian refugee, father of eight, was born after his father was displaced. He and his family are facing a serious situation because of the shrinking of UNRWA's essential services. Hatem spoke to Press TV about his fears of losing essential services like food assistance, which is the main source for his family. Talking about the shrinking supplies, Hatem is expressing his concerns about the future of his sons, who couldn't afford to marry and have their own families, as they are trying to work hard to support their younger siblings.
My sons can barely find work due to Gaza's disastrous situation amid the prolonged Israeli blockade and the rapidly rising fuel and food prices. They can hardly manage to get cooking gas and electricity. Sometimes on days like today, we don't find food on our table the whole day.
The politicization of the Palestinian refugees' plight jeopardizes the lives of over 1.2 million people in the Gaza Strip. The international community must shoulder their responsibilities towards the Palestinian refugees who were forcibly displaced from their original lands. Palestinian refugees continue to suffer since they were displaced back during the Nakba in 1948 by the Israeli occupation. The current UNRWA's financial crisis is harming thousands of Palestinian refugee families in Gaza whose only hope is not to go hungry. Al-Asif, Gaza.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. We are extraordinary in terms of our human resources. In terms of human resources, we are in a much better situation than many other countries in the world. We are above average in the world. This was also demonstrated in other sectors. This was clearly shown with regard to the atomic issue and in our nuclear industry. This is one fact. Another fact that was seen was the inhumane, unfair, coercive logic of those who oppose Iran's progress. Their behavior is coercive. In other words, their expectations from our country are behind the safeguards agreements that are commonplace in the world. They use coercive language. They say, don't do this, don't do that, don't go lower than the level of the earth, don't go more than such and such a distance over there with your structures. Why? If you are not sick, if you don't have ulterior motives, if you don't want to threaten us, why are you scared that we may have facilities in a certain impregnable location? Their inhuman, unfair logic was revealed. This is another fact that was seen in this challenge.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another fact that was revealed is the unreliability of the other parties and those who are against us with regard to their promises. So far during these many years, now those of you who have more experiences in nuclear field understand what I'm referring to, both the foreign governments that were on the opposing side of negotiations and the IAEA itself made promises on numerous occasions in different areas. However, they did not fulfill these promises. Their promises were left unfulfilled. Therefore, one of the achievements of this 20-year-long challenge was that we realized we cannot trust their promises and their words. Distrust. These are important achievements. Understand that these are important matters. We have suffered setbacks in many areas because of these types of misplaced trust. It is very important for a nation and the officials of a country to realize and understand when they should trust someone and when they shouldn't trust somebody. This is very important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. publication has obtained a classified document suggesting Washington pushed for the removal of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan from office. The document has been published by The Intercept. According to the secret cable known internally as a cipher, a meeting took place on March 7, 2022, between the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Asad Majid Khan, and two State Department officials. During the meeting, U.S. officials, including the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, encouraged the Pakistani government to remove Imran Khan over his neutrality over the war in Ukraine. The day before the meeting, Khan addressed a rally and responded directly to European calls that Pakistan rally behind Ukraine. During that rally, Khan said Pakistanis were not slaves to the Europeans and Americans. He said, "We are friends of Russia, and we are also friends of the U.S. We are friends of China and Europe. We are not part of any alliance." 1 month after the meeting with U.S. officials, a no-confidence vote was held in Parliament, leading to Khan's removal from power. The vote is believed to have been organized with the backing of Pakistan's powerful military. The cable reveals both the carrots and the sticks that the State Department deployed in its push against Khan, U.S. officials promising warmer relations if Khan was removed. They also threatened Pakistan with isolation if Khan was not removed from power. The diplomatic meeting came 2 weeks after the war began between Russia and Ukraine. Before his ouster, Khan had already accused a, quote, foreign power of funding a conspiracy to topple his democratically elected government.
So I get this message. Donald Liu is telling the ambassador that unless I, Imran Khan, is removed as the prime minister in the no-confidence motion, there'll be consequences for Pakistan. It was a conspiracy. It was the army chief. It was the guy who's the prime minister right now. And the U.S. came into it as thinking as I'm someone anti-American. Some reason, if you don't agree with the U.S. foreign policy, you're turned anti-American. First, worry about your own people rather than getting involved in conflicts.
The unnamed foreign power was interpreted as a clear reference to the U.S. Following Khan's ouster from power, Pakistan plunged into a crisis. He was elected in July 2018, promising to fight corruption and to fix the economy. But those pledges went unmet, and the world's second-largest Muslim country was gripped by a financial crisis. After Khan's removal, his supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to show their support for the removed prime minister. Since his removal from power, about 200 court cases have been lodged against Khan by the military-backed government.
All my time is spent from going from one court to another courtroom. I have made, in 2 months, over 350 court appearances. And my legal team is busy fending off one case after the other. But the thing is, nothing sticks because these are frivolous, bogus cases. And what now they are planning to do is to have military courts. And this is right now in the Supreme Court, whether the courts will allow military courts or not. And the objective of the military court is that there I certainly will be sentenced.
The former prime minister has maintained that the cases against him are politically motivated to keep him out of power. He says the country's powerful military is behind these cases. Khan has been barred from holding public office for 5 years by the country's electoral authorities. The decision was announced by the Election Commission of Pakistan days after Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption. Under Pakistani laws, a convicted person cannot run for public office for a period set out by the Election Commission of Pakistan.
The recent premature decision by the Election Commission of Pakistan is just another method for this unmandated government to try to eliminate Imran Khan from the political landscape of Pakistan. We must remember that Imran Khan was, is, and always will remain the chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the largest national-level party in the country. Imran Khan's case against him from a session court we're very confident, will be reversed.
Khan is not the first Pakistani prime minister to be convicted of alleged corruption. It is believed the political system in Pakistan is widely mired in corruption, and none of the politicians and political parties have shown any desire to fix the system. On Thursday, Pakistan's parliament was dissolved on the recommendation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, making way for a general election amid political and economic crises. But the vote could be delayed several months, with the Election Commission set to start redrawing hundreds of constituencies based on a fresh consensus. Analysts have said any delay in the election could fuel public anger and add to uncertainty in the cash-strapped country.
Iran has hosted a conference dubbed Iran and BRICS Prospects for Partnership and Cooperation at the Foreign Ministry's Institute for Political and International Studies in the capital, Tehran. Officials from the ministry, as well as a group of foreign ambassadors residing in the Iranian capital, participated in the event, which aims at identifying mutual capacities between the sides. The BRICS group of fast-developing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is often seen as an alternative to Western economic and political hegemony. It accounts for 42% of the global population and about 26% of the world's economy. Addressing the conference, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian highlighted the significant role of BRICS in driving global economic growth, saying the Islamic Republic can be a reliable and influential partner of the five-member bloc of emerging economies.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is a reliable and effective partner in bilateral and multilateral cooperation due to its unique geostrategic situation and geographical location. It has massive energy sources, especially petroleum and gas, and it has an inexpensive and short transportation channel. The country has young, skilled, and professional workers and new and innovative scientific and technological resources.
The foreign minister hailed the favorable state of Iran's political and economic relations with BRICS members and underlined the need for all sides to further boost economic ties. He also stressed that BRICS represents a powerful economic and political synergy with the potential to influence regional and global developments. The BRICS summit will be held in Johannesburg, South Africa, on August 22nd to 24th. According to South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor, among the topics to be discussed at the BRICS summit will be the organization's expansion. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has received a formal invitation from South Africa to attend the summit. Iran is among dozens of countries that seek membership in the BRICS and has submitted a formal application to join the body. For decades after the Cold War, the world witnessed a U.S. unipolar hegemonic order. In recent years, however, a new multipolar world order has been emerging, with certain countries challenging the U.S.'s economic and political dominance. Also, perceptions of American arrogance and hypocrisy are widespread. Trust in the international systems that the U.S. helped invent and has presided over since World War II is long gone. After two decades of bloody military interventions across the West Asia, namely in Afghanistan and Iraq, the United States has lost much of its moral credibility as well. Russian and Chinese leaders have long expressed a desire for a more multipolar order, as have the leaders of emerging powers such as India or Brazil. So has Iran. And for the Islamic Republic, BRICS can be the next significant target of its multilateralism policy. According to the latest data released by the Islamic Republic of Iran Customs Administration, the value of Iran's non-oil trade with BRICS group of countries hits $38.43 billion in the 2022-2023 fiscal year, showing a 14% hike compared to the same period a year earlier. That's while the West, particularly the U.S., have imposed several rounds of unilateral sanctions against Tehran. Many states have been applying for membership in international bodies in a bid to promote multilateralism and counter unilateral policies. In addition, last month, Iran gained full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the world's largest regional organization in terms of geographic scope and population. In an address to a meeting of the Friends of BRICS foreign ministers in Cape Town in June, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran is among the pioneers of multilateralism. He added that the era of unilateralism is coming to an end and that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS group of countries will play major roles in the future as a new world order is emerging. More than 3,000 United States military personnel have arrived in the Red Sea aboard two warships after Washington said it would boost its military footprint in the region amid rising tensions with Iran. The sailors arrived while traveling on the USS Bataan, an amphibious assault ship that can carry more than 20 aircraft, and on the USS Carter Hull landing ship. Both ships entered the Red Sea after crossing the Mediterranean Sea and passing through the Suez Canal. The reinforcements will secure existing air and naval assets of the 5th Fleet, which is based in Bahrain and operates in the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Oman, and the Indian Ocean, including critical strategic choke points in the Strait of Hormuz and Suez Canal. The move follows an announcement last week by U.S. military officials to deploy a security guard composed of Marines on board commercial tankers passing through and near the Strait of Hormuz to form an additional layer of defense for these ships. The U.S. Navy accused Iran of attacking, seizing, or attempting to seize nearly 20 internationally flagged merchant vessels in the region over the past 2 years. However, an informed Iranian defense source has told Iranian media that Tehran has made no efforts to seize oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, denying an earlier U.S. claim accusing Tehran of trying to take control of two ships. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Navy has over the past years foiled several attacks on both Iranian and foreign tankers in the strategic Persian Gulf region and other high seas. The IRGC's Navy confiscated more than 50 million liters of smuggled fuel, mainly diesel, in various missions last year. That's while the U.S. Navy has seized Iranian ships carrying oil in transit to China in recent months, in an effort to enforce U.S. sanctions on Iran that seek to harm the Islamic Republic's economy. In a Monday press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, said U.S. deployments are only serving Washington's interests.
The U.S. government's military presence in the region has never created security. Their interests in this region have always compelled them to feel instability and insecurity. We are deeply convinced that the countries of the Persian Gulf are capable of ensuring their own security.
Iran says it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its security and a source of tension and instability in the region. The U.S. announced last month that it would deploy a destroyer, F-35, and F-16 warplanes to the West Asia. Last week, the U.S. military claimed it was considering putting armed personnel on commercial ships traveling through the Strait of Hormuz to stop Iran from harassing vessels. Tehran responded on Saturday by saying it was equipping its Revolutionary Guards Navy with drones and 1,000-kilometer range missiles. The IRGC also issued a warning to the United States, saying the Islamic Republic is powerful enough to respond in kind to any act of mischief by the U.S. in the region. Also, on 3rd of August, naval forces of the Iranian Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched surprise military drills in the Persian Gulf islands of Abu Musa, Greater Tomb, and Lesser Tomb. The naval exercise was to display the IRGC Navy's might as well as combat and defense preparedness in protecting the Persian Gulf's security and the Iranian islands. During the drills, various units of the IRGC were expected to exercise a range of military tactics. Iranian military experts and engineers have in recent years made remarkable breakthroughs in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. Iranian officials have made clear that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, including its missile power, which are entirely meant for defense.
Two days of peace negotiations aimed at bringing an end to the conflict in Ukraine has ended without any major breakthrough in the Saudi city of Jeddah. The only achievement of the talks was what the participants said, agreeing on the importance of continuing consultations to pave the way for peace in Ukraine. European officials said those taking part plan to establish working groups to address specific problems raised by the war. More than 40 countries, including China, India, the United States, and European countries, were taking part in negotiations, but Russia was not invited. In an address to participants, Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country's delegation was pushing a 10-point peace formula which calls on the full withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukraine territory. The peace plan also calls for the restoration of Ukraine's borders and the territory of Crimea.
In total, 42 countries are represented there, different continents, different political approaches to global affairs, but all are united by the priority of international law. And that is why Ukraine proposed the peace formula, because the rules-based international order, which was violated by Russian aggression, must be restored.
Head of Ukraine delegation Andriy Yermak hailed the negotiations, saying we had very productive consultations on the key principles on which a just and lasting peace should be built. Yermak said different viewpoints emerged during the talks in Saudi Arabia, calling them an extremely honest, open conversation. Russia, however, saw Saudi talks as West's effort to mobilize the global South to support President Zelensky's peace plan, saying such efforts are doomed to failure. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the West, with its usual sly and deceitful manner, is trying to induce some countries to support Zelensky's position. Moscow had earlier described the event as a farcical move intended to forge an anti-Russia coalition. The negotiations in Saudi Arabia comes as several countries attending the Jeddah event have been critical of Russia's absence in the talks. That includes Brazil, with head of its delegation, Celso Amorim, saying any real negotiation must include all parties, including Russia. Amorim said if we really want peace, we have to involve Moscow in this process in some form. France questioned the length of negotiations in Jeddah, saying long-term efforts are needed to reach sustainable peace in Ukraine. This is while now 18 months into the Russia-Ukraine conflict, any prospect of direct peace talks between Kiev and Moscow appears remote. But apart from deep differences between Russia and Ukraine, which have kept the two warring sides away from reaching a solution to the conflict, what has made things even worse is the West's all-out military and financial support for Kiev. Despite Russia's repeated warnings that such military assistance would only prolong the war, Western countries left stone unturned to provide Kiev with military aid packages worth tens of billions of dollars. Not to mention that such an assistance not only have failed to prevent the conflict from getting exacerbated, but instead has led to even more escalation on both sides. But the supply of military aids to Ukraine has its own opponents in the West. In a recent protest in German capital Berlin, the demonstrators warned of more deaths in Ukraine as a result of Western military support for Kiev.
Delivery of weapons only means death in Ukraine. Thereby, this is only prolonging the war and suffering of the civilian population.
We have to prevent it in advance and not prevent it when it's already happening. It should have been prevented before the first shots came. It should have been prevented before the escalation was built up by interested parties. Now it's difficult. The hatred is very big on both sides.
The supply of weapons to Ukraine comes as the United States, the largest donor of military aid to Ukraine, has provided more than $46 billion since the war began in February 2022. Meanwhile, the European Union has so far provided nearly $30 billion in military assistance to Ukraine for the war with Russia. Putting all those Western aids into context, what seems to be terrifying is that the Russian-Ukraine war has the potentiality to turn into a global conflict. But in case of such a scenario, the catastrophic consequences of the conflict will be without a doubt hard to imagine.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is
Youth Station.
You're yes, back it again. Is. I am Asma at your service.
And I am Beta at your service again.
Yes, it's so, so much a happy thing.
It is.
To be here in Youth Station with Beta. And it's going to be an amazing day.
This is our sweet home, and you cannot just imagine how much we love here.
Especially as in for today.
Yeah.
Because just the last night, I had such a very bad headache.
Yeah.
And you know, what does it mean when you have a headache?
I know, I had it too.
A severe sort of headache is just a sort of a thing that is not easy to tolerate.
I know. This is really difficult.
Yeah.
Because last night I had the same problem, unfortunately. I don't know why. It's about, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 days. I'm going through really heavy headaches. I don't know why, but it really bothers me. You know, it's like you cannot do anything. At the same time, you have the energy to do your routine things, but you cannot do anything.
I have a lot to do, and then I have no focus because when the headache comes, then all the focus gets away and gets scattered. So
it's like,
this is going to be like a miserable hell.
Yeah, it's a kind of limitation that you don't choose and you cannot control, you cannot do anything.
Exactly.
And it's a pain in the neck at the end.
So in those situations when you have headache, what do you do?
That's a nice question, actually, in those situations. You know? and by headache, I think you don't mean just headache itself. We have like other spiritual headaches too, you know?
Exactly.
And other times you feel like, okay, my head is going to be exploded and I'm going to die. You know, there are times I think all the listeners even have gone through such a thing in
exactly.
their lives. And these are the times that the only thing I think that works on me is patience.
Yeah.
It's easy to say, but being patient is one of the hardest things I've been through in my whole life.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you cannot do anything, and by trying and struggling to do something, just
you get even more entangled.
Exactly. You are making everything more intense and more miserable.
Yeah, because, more complicated.
Yeah, because there is no benefit in doing something when you cannot do anything. You know?
Yeah.
And instead of just being an absurd person who is trying to do just something in order to calm your soul, just you have to try to be patient.
Yeah. As for me, since it is a migraine, so it's a sort of a severe headache. So whenever I go through those attacks, I actually have to close my eyes and get into a dark room and then stay silent, try to sleep. Actually,
it's
trying
a bit difficult,
to sleep.
I think.
Of course it is. But since you have some painkillers, they would do half of the way for you.
I don't take painkillers at all.
Well, I take them, but just in situations where everything is just getting out of my control.
Yeah, I get it.
Sometimes even them won't work.
Yeah.
But they sometimes do the trick for me. So now, coming to the problems that get into the middle of our lives, which have got the same sort of feelings as in headaches and other sort of diseases, even there are some sort of sicknesses that are so much worse than the problems.
Yeah.
So in all of them, in coming to encounter all of these problems, all of these sicknesses, the first thing that we should do is to sit
and clear everything out.
I do in our head. That one, and let me clear this point that we have to go for a short break.
Yes. So we actually would be back in no time. Thank you for staying with us. Yes, so speaking of all the problems and all the headaches, the physical headaches and the mental headaches
that we are going through. I think the mental ones are so much stronger.
Exactly. And yeah, by the way, this is Youth Station. I am Asma.
And I am Beta. I'm here.
Yes, and we're talking about problems that get in our life and we have no way to get out of them. So what's the moral behind each problem that gets into our life is the question that we get to think about whenever we are put in those situations.
You know, this is a really nice question. Let me first elaborate the things that you mentioned that we have to first make everything clear for ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you come to this point that you don't know anything about all the things that happen to your life. You know, it's like a turning point. You come to yourself and that you lose someone really important to you. I don't know, you have a disease that you didn't know.
Let me just say it right in here. Usually all the problems come together.
Exactly.
Misery has got companies.
Yeah.
So when you are getting into these hard and complicated situations, it's very difficult actually to get to see, okay, what's going on?
Yeah.
Wait a moment. Let me just clear the question for myself.
No, I just think all the things that happens sometimes in your life at the same time is really difficult. And, you know, sometimes it's like a loop. When you think more about your difficulties and your problems just, you know, get stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
And
this because being stronger, they would get a hold of you.
Exactly.
Because you would think like they are actually controlling you.
There are, you know, and there are many ways to just help you in this road, like thinking about the reason and the story of all these things that are happening to you.
And since human beings are just different from each other, just like our fingerprints, we're unique to ourselves and we're just a limited edition. We have actually talked about it previously. Well, I guess the solution to a problem differs from one person to another. Maybe my sort of reaction toward problems is going to be different from yours. And then the cycle goes just like this. But the thing is, now, leaving the solutions aside, we come to this point that why do we have such problems? And me personally have got it from my own problems that there is a capacity in me that needs to be cleared out for myself, that needs to be identified and recognized by myself. So God actually is there, is helping me. Yeah. Then the problems that happen haphazardly in my life, or even the problems that have been the reaction of the actions I have done in my past, or the problems that just come out of nowhere, all of them are meant to make me know myself more and more and show me that I am not the restricted person, the weak person that I think I am. I'm this stronger me, but I have just to find it out.
Yeah, you know, this is a really nice perspective on this issue that I have it myself, but from somehow another point of view. Like, I call it a philosophy of examination. You know, sometimes you have to be examined in order to get stronger.
Yeah.
And in order to just get to this point that you know something about yourself. You know, without these kind of things, these bitter things that happens in our life, we cannot understand our capacity, as you mentioned, and we cannot understand the things we learned up to here. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if there is happiness in life, you won't actually appreciate this happiness unless there is sadness in your life too.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be a combination of all these two. And there may be some people who thinks like, no, it's not like a combination in my life. It's all misery, it's all sadness, it's all this and all that. Maybe this is about your perspective. Maybe this is about you, not the life. And the thing is, we mostly try to turn the blame and, you know, put the blame on someone. We're trying to find someone in our life to put the blame on that and tell them, okay, this is your problem. This is the problem of life. This is the problem
and
of
just
that.
To exonerate yourself from all the issues that happen.
But sometimes this is just what it is. You know, cannot change it. But you can change yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is the way, and this is the philosophy I keep in my mind. Whenever I go through these miseries and difficulties, and one of the difficulties is that we have limited time here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Always running out of time.
So we're going to go for a short break. Stay tuned, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
It listed was a break, not the finishing point.
Yeah, but the finishing point is near and close.
Yeah, this is the finalement. So, yeah, you were just saying that we shouldn't point the finger at others and we shouldn't blame the others for everything. And I guess the journey of knowing yourself better and better starts from time when you just point the finger at yourself.
Exactly.
When you start to figure out who you truly are, what have you done, why this problem is coming to you and why all this is just happening to you. You have to find the moral behind it, just as I told you. It's going to sound just so difficult, but we all have been through all of these things. And, you know, I always say it in here that life is not a promised heaven we are just looking for.
Yeah.
This is not going to be the trick for life. This is not the definition of life. Life is a place for getting tested. Life is a place where you go through too much of things to know your capacities, to know yourself, to know the concepts that you have to be familiar with, like, you know, friendship, like patience, like trusting other people, like trust, of course, in your Lord, in the one who's there always for you. So all of these things do not come by accident. If you're a person, as it has been so much said in here, I have said it a million times that a silent sea does not make a perfect sailor.
Yeah,
in order to be such a perfect sailor, you have to go through whirlpools, you have to go through hurricanes and all of these things. You have to experience all of them in order just to know who you truly are and how would you act in difficult situations. So the problems are not just the miseries meant to make you sad, make your tears come out. They are actually the things that are going to reveal yourself to yourself more and more, for some facts to be proved for yourself. Like sometimes I think, okay, I am just an honest person, but if I am put in a difficult situation, I'm going to test myself and it's going to be proven to me. And it's going to be proof to me whether I am going to be honest or no. It was just the coats of a person sitting in a silent sea, sitting on a very peaceful shore, talking about the winds that get in a whirlpool. So,
So, you know, I think more than the pastimes, because we are facing a kind of idealistic point of view in this world, in this modern world, we are like, okay, I want to be the ideal type of myself. So I claim that I'm honest. I claim that I'm this and that. And, you know, these kind of things that you are claiming should be proven. You know, this is life. And life is not easy. Life is not kind. Life is just a kind of, I think, cruel teacher. I always remind myself that, okay,
with no tutorial, you're going to get into the very main project.
Exactly. And there are two things that I think they have to be mentioned together, which are patience and knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, there is actually this hadith from Imam Bukhari, peace be upon him, that patience is the cloth of a scholar. So do not make yourself naked of these clothes.
You
so,
know, speaking of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, I just remembered some quotes from one of the dear imams. The thing which is so important is the main idea of their code.
Sure.
They said that for each and every single problem that you suffer from, for that slight moment of sadness that gets into your heart of not having a penny in your pocket or of suffering from a special sort of, I don't know, problem in your life, there is going to be a lantern getting ready for you and the other world. So just imagine how many lanterns are you going to have.
Yeah, this is beautiful at the same time to sad.